The Sunday Grill with Orla Rapple on Beat 102-103.
You're listening to The Sunday Grill. It is Beat, and I've got some 2026 dates for your diary now. Yep, let that sink in. 2026. Because Pat and Faith Short come to the Theatre Royal in Waterford and the Riverside Hotel in Enniscorthy in January of the new year. Faith Short joins me this morning to tell us more. You're very welcome, Faith.
Thank you, Orla, for having me.
Good to have you on.
A bit mad there saying 2026. That sounds a bit, it sounds wrong, but it is well and truly upon us, isn't it?
It's crazy. When I was a child, I never thought of the 2020s. I didn't get that far.
I know. I don't want to look at it as an overview. I just want to go, okay, look, we're heading into the new year. Not, you know, yeah, it's absolutely mad. But we are looking forward to it. Yeah, the gigs are kind of, to be honest, most weekends now up until Christmas.
Yeah, have a date in Kilkenny in December, but that didn't add to my shock of 2026. But you are in the Watergate, is it? In December is one of your dates. Yeah,
that's pretty much sold out now. So okay. I think there's only like a handful of tickets left. But yeah, we're in the Theatre Royal Waterford. Love Waterford. And then obviously Enniscorthy as well.
Yeah.
All tickets are on www.patshort.com. But yeah, it's been a bit of a whirlwind. We only started this tour about a month ago, I think.
And you've dates all the way up to April. It must be so weird to think that far ahead.
I'm probably one of the only in my friend group who know exactly what they're doing on a random Saturday 5 months ahead. Bit of a pain in the hole, but also, you know, it's work at the end of the day, so it's good to have the money coming in.
Can you?
Especially in the old... Go on.
You are obviously doing the show with your dad. It is called Short Stuff because it's Pat and Faith Short. Can you remember the first time you became aware that your dad didn't do the sort of job that most dads did?
I think kind of he had a TV show called Killing a Scully, and it was around during the early 2000s and when it started, and I would have been in primary school at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember when people were like, oh geez, I was watching your dad on Sunday. And I was like, that's a bit weird now, isn't it? Like that everyone knows who my parents are and I haven't a clue what your parents do. So yeah, primary school would have been the first time. But as I've said before, like it's when it's normal to you as a kid, it's very normal. You don't really know anything else. So it's because it's all, you know. So, yeah, and it was exciting growing up because, like, you know, we got brought on set and things like that and behind stages and, you know. As I said, it's so normal as a kid, and it's only kind of when you look back when you're older that you go, oh, wow, that was a pretty cool experience to have when you're only, like, 10 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And when did you start to realise that you'd like to do the same?
So when I was filling out my CAO for the Leaving Cert, I hadn't a clue what I wanted to do, but I was doing drama the whole time throughout primary and secondary. Mm-hmm. And then I was kind of like, oh God, I don't know what I want to do as a job to make money. I don't know if I'm going to actually enjoy doing a business course or whatever. And then it was my mom who was like, well, you know, you could give the old acting a shot, like if you wanted to audition for drama schools and everything. And I think it was kind of when mom planted the seed. I was like, oh yeah, I could actually try and make a career out of it.
That is mad, because you don't really hear, but it's usually the story of my parents said, no, you'd never make a career out of that, you know.
Oh, completely. No, my parents are absolutely brilliant. They were so, my mom in particular, because my dad would have been working the whole time when I was filling out Leaving Cert courses and all that, but she was so she really directed me. I wouldn't, you know, she didn't push me either. She just definitely planted the seed and was very much like, look, there's no point picking something if you know you don't want to do it and you're not going to enjoy it, because otherwise you're just kind of flogging a dead horse. So I auditioned for it, and then I got it, and that was kind of it. I was like, if I get it, I'll do it. If I don't, I'll find another path.
And you got it.
Yeah, got it in the end. Yeah, thank God.
Brilliant.
God, I went to the Gaiety School of Acting for drama. And yeah, in Dublin. It was great.
And then the pandemic kind of sealed the deal for working with your dad. Is that right?
Yes, you're right. Yeah, you've done your research, Jordan. You're on the ball. it was COVID. And I don't know if we would have ended up working together as closely if COVID didn't happen. Because I was living in Dublin and I moved home because of COVID, because rent prices were going up through the roof, mm-hmm. and I had no job or whatever. So I moved home and we started doing sketches together online and stuff. And then we got asked to do a TV show. We got asked to do a sketch for a TV show online. And yeah, it just kind of took it. It went from there. It was brilliant. Yeah.
Brilliant. It must feel like kind of special to spend so much time with your family member in your 20s. This thing keeps coming up for me on my Instagram. I must have clicked on something about how little time from 18 on your children will get to spend with you.
Oh geez, the novelty wears off a little bit now, Orla.
But are you pals? Do you have the same sort of personality? Do you rub along together
We do. Yeah, we do. We genuinely do get on great. But like any family, you have your tiffs, like you really do. And I would say we're both very open about this. The best thing ever that happened was me moving to Dublin for this other job that I got, because we were together 24/7. Oh, like we also did a tour in Australia and New Zealand, wow. Which was incredible. But I got this job in Spain, 103.8, mm-hmm. in Dublin, the radio station. And I knew after Australia that I was going to be moving up to Dublin. And we both said, you know what, it's the best thing. Because you can't live with someone, work with someone, and also be related to that said person. Do you know what
exactly.
I mean?
That is a lot. That is a
lot. It's a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
But we made it work for however long. Because I wasn't moving to Dublin unless I needed to. Because obviously mm-hmm. rent is exactly. an arm and a leg. So yeah, no, happy out now though.
And now you're back doing a tour again. So it's obviously like an equation that works for you. What can people expect from the show? How would you even describe the short stuff?
So it's a comedy show, obviously, but mm-hmm. it's very much like sketch comedy. For anyone that hasn't seen Pat perform before, it's sketch comedy. It's very much kind of theatrical. So it's very quick paced. There's different characters moving constantly. There's a bit of stand up as well, but the whole show was not stand up. So it's definitely a unique show. Like there's not a lot of them out there at the moment. There is costume as well. It's great crack. It's very funny. It's worth it. It's for all ages as well. Like it definitely. It caters to all ages, which I think is so brilliant about it. Like you see teenagers coming with their parents, which is obviously quite rare. And you see, you know, middle-aged people coming with their parents. Uh-huh. And it's just great to see that it's catering to all age groups.
And that must be great for the two of you, because it's not just about comedy. It's about your acting chops as well, that you're both very involved.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. You feel like you're still keeping the acting streak in you going as well, because it's definitely not just you and a mic. You mm-hmm. know, I definitely feel like I'm acting a lot of the nights, you know, doing characters and stuff like that. It's definitely feels like more like acting, which is great.
Brilliant stuff. Well, listen, as you said, there's very few tickets left for the Watergate and Kilkenny date for the short stuff, which is, of course, Pat and Faye Short. That's the 13th of December, if you want to run and have a look and see if there's any tickets for that date. But let's talk 2026 in the Southeast. You're on the 13th. No, sorry, we'll start with the 9th of January at the Riverside in Enniscorthy in County Wexford, which is a lovely venue right by the river in Enniscorthy.
Yeah.
And then the absolutely beautiful Theatre Royal in Waterford is where you'll be on the 30th. Of January, and probably the best place that people can go to is Pat's website, would it be?
Yes, patshorts.com. All the tickets are there, and
good stuff. That is patshort.com. Best of luck with everything, Faye.
Thanks, Orla.
Enjoy it. Enjoy Christmas and all those dates.
We will
until April. I hope you have them written in a diary somewhere. Thanks a million for talking to
me
this
Orla.
Morning.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rappel on Beat 102-103.
It's Beat of a Sunday. You are listening to The Sunday Grill, and Michael Fortune of folklore.ie fame has a new book out. It's called The Folklore of Wexford. And before you think folklore, that's not for me, well, he has some great stories in it that'll make you the storyteller of your gang over Christmas time, or could even make a great Christmas present for the parents, the grandparents, or the in-laws. As I said, it's called The Folklore of Wexford, and Michael joins me this morning to get into it. Lovely to hear from you again, Michael.
Delighted to be back on the show with you. Thanks
you
a
seem
million.
To have more hours in the day than I do anyway, because you're always doing something.
I'm always doing something like that still. Yeah. Yeah. And especially this time of year, you know, when you're hitting deadlines to get things to get things to print. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
You don't find yourself saying, I'll spend an hour there watching The Real Housewives of California.
No.
thought that. Michael, I was just on your folklore.ie Facebook page and you had brought up something that I talk to my friends about every winter and they say they have never heard of it. When I used to sit at the fire, my father would constantly say to me, don't sit so close, you'll get ABCs. Is that a real Wexford thing?
Well, yeah, it's particular to Wexford. ABCs, diamonds, what else do they call them?
Corned beef.
Yeah, there's different names for them. And it's from a time when people would be hatching the fire, as they said. But definitely it's very, very, very strong in Wexford. But you get it in other counties will have it as well. I suppose, come here to me, since central heating has changed our lives, we don't be sitting in front of the fire as much as we used to. You know,
I definitely have a few ABCs on my leg from standing at the fire when I was freezing. It's those kind of pockmarks almost, isn't it?
Yeah, they're almost like tights, whatever. And you know what, as well, Orla, as well, people always said, oh, that one's got ABCs or ABCs as well, but they'd say with the old vowel shift, they say, oh, that one's got ABCs. And be kind of seen as a, and it'd be other women saying it, but other women I found as well. And it'd be kind of like a derogatory term, saying, oh, that one there, she's doing nothing, sitting by the fire, doing nothing around the house.
I hope some other people remember that this morning. And I think that's the really, like, lovely thing about what you're doing with folklore.ie is you're recording these oral parts of our culture and history that can be just forgotten, really, can't they?
Yeah, and you know what? It's funny. I actually think there's a real, absolutely, and it's just shined a light on those. And I actually think there's a great interest in with younger people, people in their 20s and 30s, they wouldn't have had it. I've seen it, like I see it on YouTube and TikToks and that kind of stuff as well. There's followings and interest in that, which is great to see, you know. And that's relatively new. That's only in the last 5 years, I'd say.
And there's some great stories out there for younger people as well when it comes to folklore and what motivated younger people back in the day.
Absolutely. Well, even the schools, like even go to the smallies, uh-huh. Like the role that the children played in the school's folklore collection back in 1937-38, like that, if anyone, your listeners don't know that, it's an amazing resource called Dukas.ie. It's the Folklore Commission. And they got children, primary school children all over the country to go collect folklore off their aunts and uncles and neighbours and grannies. And it's all available online. And nearly every school in the country will have a copybook. And it's packed to the gills with lovely, lovely accounts, local accounts. And you wouldn't know what you'd find in it, you know, history, folklore, words, sayings, songs. It's brilliant. It's like it's a lovely rabbit hole to go down.
Gorgeous stuff. Now tell us about the folklore of Wexford. So what are you doing with this new book?
Yeah, well, back in 2023, I did volume one, and it was all stuff in my head, and also stuff I would have used on the folklore.ie page. Like I'd use it as a research tool in some ways. So people would write in, oh, God, my mother did this, or we did that, or we did the other. So I was using it as that kind of space. So I produced a book, and maybe it's getting older as well. I spent 25 years recording digital video, and I see the value of printed word more and more. So volume two, basically, volume one just sold out. It was ridiculous. I wasn't expecting it at all. It sold out before it was even released, so I had to get reprints. So it's designed and printed in Ireland, but it's just jam-packed with kind of local stuff, so, you know, from folkloric accounts, little customs, little bits of history, words, sayings, songs. And naturally, because even though we're in Wexford, this crossover into Waterford and Kilkenny and Carlow is huge. Okay. Like there's one whole section on about the first, in the first book I did, or I had about the arrival of the first magpie tour. No magpies in Ireland until they landed in Wexford the late 1600s, and that's well documented. And all the folklore we have about waving and spitting and blessing ourselves, that all goes back
to
that.
And what do you mean they landed in Wexford in the late 1600s?
Yeah, there was loads of written accounts of the lack of magpies or the lack of pies. So in God, off the top of my head now, around 1680, there was a dozen of magpies blew in and a storm from Wales, and they landed down near southeast Wexford, down near Ladies Island. And ever since then, there was a great account by a man called Solomon Richards. He wrote an account. He lived in Wexford town. He was Cromwell left him there. And he wrote an account saying, "A native Irish much detest these birds, saying they'll never be rid of the English once these magpies remain." And funny, and that folklore, I heard a man up in Ballyedmond in North Wexford had the exact folklore and that same story. So they were always seen as a kind of a foreign bird. They were seen as a kind of a foreign bird, and people were kind of distrustful of them. And the exact same thing crops up in Waterford. In the Volume 2 book, there's an account of the first frogs that were spotted in Waterford with the Normans. And again, there's that kind of thing. This is doleful news for Ireland. We don't know what. Like, they'd never seen a frog before. There's a great guy called Gerald of Wales is his name. He came in with the Normans, came in a couple of years after them, and he wrote Chronicle. Now, he didn't like the Irish, now, to be fair, but he wrote good accounts, and the accounts, you can take them with a pinch of salt. But one of his accounts was basically the boys in Waterford and the boys in Kilkenny all meeting and looking at this frog and basically figuring out where in an image, what?
Where did this frog come from? It must look like a little alien.
Yeah. But there were no rabbits in Ireland either before the frogs as well. Like, there's loads of things. There was a slip of the tongue before the Normans, and there was no rabbits like that. So there's loads of little things that they brought in, yeah.
Okay.
But that's a lovely account in it, and the account is in the book as well. I'm looking at it here right now as I'm flicking through the book.
And then there's something else that you write about, which, am I right in saying, kind of has origins in the GAA, and that's called faction fighting.
There's a great account. Yeah, there's a faction fighting was huge. Like Tipperary was probably the king of the Tipperary, Kilkenny, it was strong Kilkenny, and obviously here in Wexford as well. But I think every county had faction fighting right through the 1800s. And there's a grave near me in Ballandagan. And there was a young chap called Cowman. And it said on it, the chap's name, James Cowman, 28, whatever he was. And it said, inhumanely murdered at the fair at Money Whore. And at these fairs years ago, there would have always been fighting going on the whole time. But they said once the GAA was established, it helped kind of... And you know what? Come here, you know, it's still like county boundaries are county boundaries in certain counties. And you know what line this, you know what line it, you go on one side and the other. And there's a lovely account of that whole... Well, I wasn't a lovely tradition. It was fairly bloody violent. But there are some funny accounts. There's one account of these two villages near me called Blackwater and Clamuckridge. It was usual crack. The one lad was taunting the other fella, and he said, "Like, we're going to meet this stream." And it was a little stream dividing both parishes. And I said, "We're going to meet here some Sunday." And all the Clamuckridge lads met there one Sunday anyway. And whoever, this is pure monkey stuff, whoever's put his foot over that stream into the other man's territory, that was a signal for the fight to start. So the Clamuckridge men all gathered anyway, and a couple of black watermen came down. Next minute, one of the Clamuckridge men decided to put his foot across and looked over the hill, and there was hundreds of black watermen. So the Clamuckridge lads, they quickly hooked it, and the story is recorded ever since.
And these are the sort of stories that are in your book?
Loads of them, yeah. And little stories about... kind of serpents. We have a kind of a version of a Loch Ness monster, well, a mild version of a Loch Ness monster in Wexford. It's called Loch Na Pasty, and it's lovely. Again, there's a place name called Loch Na Pasty near Gortsheen. There's also a place name called Powell Pasty, and there's a couple of any name with Powell usually means a hole from the Irish, like a marl hole or some kind of a hole.
Okay.
And Pasty is usually a reference to an eel. Really, there were eels there, but over time, you know yourself, when there's grandfathers and uncles and telling stories, over time this eel went from 1 foot to maybe 14 foot overnight, and then all the stories kind of developed. And there's one great story about the cabinets of Burroughs having to come down and throw a bag of charcoal down this fella's neck and go in and cut and kill him from the inside out. But do you know what these stories are all about? I kind of find, I get excited about them because I like listening to them. These stories are only being told in the oral tradition. There's very little written about them. Like, I'm constantly recording and collecting the stuff and then sharing it back. That's the folklore page, is a great sharing space, and it's also a research space. Some people don't realise that I use it as a research space as well.
Brilliant stuff. Well, it's called the folklore of Wexford, and it might be a good present if you're hoping to impress some people from Wexford or beyond. You are having a book launch. You'll be in Easton's in Wexford this coming Thursday, and then Easton's in Gorey in Friday as well, if you want to meet the man himself. That is Michael Fortune, and he is the man behind folklore.ie, and The Folklore of Wexford is his new volume. Michael, thanks a million for joining me this morning.
Thanks a million for having me.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rapple on Beat 102-103.
Across the southeast, you are listening to Beat, and I've got a Christmas idea for you just outside the southeast now. This is the very first Fitz Christmas Fitz Festival. Oh, that's a hard one to say, Michael. It's taking place at Fitz of Inch, which is in Stradbally in County Laois, which you'll know, of course, if you are a frequenter of Electric Picnic. And it takes place over one weekend from December 12th to the 14th. And organiser Michael Fitzpatrick joins me this morning. Fitz Christmas Festival. That is a tough one, Michael.
Good morning, Ola. How are you doing?
Morning.
Yes, it's a tongue twister, but the Fitzwich Christmas Festival, yeah, we're super excited for it. It's our first Christmas festival.
And are you the Fitz of Fitz?
I am. I'm Fitzpatrick, so yeah.
Okay, so tell us, what is Fitz of Inch?
Fitz of Inch is a country house, so we do self-catering exclusive rentals. So we do a lot of like weddings, hen parties, stags, birthdays, corporate retreats. So we do a wide variety of things. Basically, people can come in and rent the venue for their event.
Wow. And how long have you been doing that?
We opened in 2016. So it's a long time going, but we really got going, I suppose, thanks to COVID. It definitely pushed us on a good bit in trying to come up with new creative ideas and expanding our network, I suppose, of people that like the clientele to come and see us.
Gorgeous. And I see you have a hot tub, which is always a plus.
Yes, that's a big hit with everyone. We have loads of things on: fire pit, hot tubs, karaoke, large dining rooms.
Okay.
So much to do. Most people, when they come, they kind of just tend to stay in with us because there's so much to do on site.
And is this somewhere you grew up or a business that you bought?
Yeah, no, so I grew up there and it was a lovely place to grow up. And what's lovely now is to be able to share that with people, and people are able to have the memories that I had there growing up.
Gorgeous. I'm just looking at photos of it here. It's absolutely stunning. A real like Irish country house.
Yeah, it's very traditional. It's very traditional, but we've tried to mix in some modern bits to kind of keep it up to date with everything. But we've tried to keep it as a traditional farmhouse in kind of rural Ireland. And I think that's probably the most attractive thing to people, because when you live in a city or you live in apartments, or, you know, you don't see the stillness and the quietness in the countryside. And it's really beautiful.
Lovely stuff. I presume you're very busy around Electric Picnic then, are you?
Oh gosh, yes, yeah, we're booked up for this year coming and the following year already, so it's great.
Well, let's talk Christmas then, because this is your first Christmas event. What made you think of Christmas and Fitz of Inch?
Well, Christmas is one of my favourite times of year personally. And I thought, you know what, why not? Let's do something around Christmas because we love it so much. And we really go all out with the decorations. It was definitely something I've had on my mind for the last maybe 2 years. But I suppose getting to build up to do it, the organisation, bringing in the team of people and all the behind the scenes. So it's been a good build up to it. But I'm so excited now that we're doing it this year, and I've just launched into it. And you know, Christmas is such a special time of year for families, and you know, for kids especially. Like, it's just such a beautiful time of year.
And you're really at the stage when you have it over the weekend where Christmas is totally ramped up. So it's the 12th to the 14th of December, so that'll be full of the Christmas spirit, and you've loads going on. Tell us. And the community is very much involved, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, each evening we'll have a Christmas concert. So the first half of the concert will be a local community group. And then in the second half will be kind of a headliner act. But an important part of it is the community, because in the middle of the two concerts, we have our raffle, and both the raffles will be there to help out a cause that the community want to raise funds for. So it's really, really important that they get involved, and they've been so involved up to date as well. They've really rallied through and been so supportive of it. But there's lots going on. We'll have our food and crafts market, and then we'll have the Visit Santa experience itself. There's so much to talk about with that. And then we'll have our festive concerts in the evening. So lots going on.
Good stuff. And a magical Santa experience, I hear.
Yes, it's going to be something special. Our Santa will be there on the day. He's super excited to meet all the children, and making sure they're all on the nice list for it. We'll have Mrs. Claus there with some hot cocoa, and she'll be there doing some storytelling with the children. And we'll also have the Grinch. So the Grinch will be there for a lovely treasure hunt at the very end. So
it's not,
it'll be a real full experience for the kids.
Because I don't often see the Grinch, so... He must have thought Vince's was the place to
be. No, he's been getting
up
to mischief.
Oh, very good. And a market as well over the weekend.
Yeah, we'll have a fantastic Christmas market with loads of local like crafters, you know, from jewellery to crocheting to food, patisseries. So there'll be loads going on.
Great stuff. Well, it sounds like something to add to your festive calendar. It is in Stradbally in County Laois. Fitz's of Inch is what it's called. Is it just outside Stradbally then, Michael?
Yeah, so we're just outside of Stradbally. So we're between Vicarstown and Stradbally. So we're right in the middle, and it's going to be a great event. We're really looking forward to it, and we're looking forward to welcoming everybody down to Fitz of Inch.
Brilliant stuff. So that is the 12th to the 14th of December. And the things that people need to book are what? The concerts and the Santa?
Yeah, so you can book everything online. Just go on to www.fitzofinch.com and you can book all your tickets there, and the different time slots are all available online as well. Just bear in mind, we are selling out for certain time slots, the popular ones during the day. And we'll also have the Rosa Tralee there for our opening ceremony.
Good stuff. And then people can just arrive and go to the market if they want to and things. If they want
to absolutely. People can come in and browse our crafts market. Yeah.
Lovely stuff. It is the 12th to the 14th of December. Fitz of Inch is what you need to search if you want to find out more details. It is fitzofinch.com. And if you want to book anything, that is Stradbally in, or just outside Stradbally in County Laois. Michael, thanks a million for joining me. I'm sure you're very busy, but enjoy the run up to that Christmas event.
Thanks very much. We're really looking forward to it, and we can't wait to see everyone out.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rapple on Beat 102-103.
It's Sunday morning, you're listening to Beat, and the story that's been dominating the headlines over the last few weeks in both the sporting and legal world has been the sentencing of former Kilkenny All-Star hurler DJ Carey, who was sentenced to 5.5 years in prison for defrauding 22 people out of almost €400,000 by pretending he needed treatment for cancer. Well, Sportsbeat Extra presenter Audrin Johnson caught up with Emer Ní Bhreanán, author of The Dodger, DJ Carey and the Great Betrayal, which, drawing on over 100 interviews, gives an unrivalled account of DJ's financial scams, his fake cancer claims and his portrayal of those who trusted him most. Here is some of that interview between Audrin and Emer.
Emer, thank you so much for joining me. The Dodger, DJ Carey and the Great Betrayal, a culmination of years of work for you on your part, but it obviously goes before that as well, channeling all the way back to your southeast roots, kind of covering topics in Kilkenny and the surrounding counties in Carlow as well, obviously with the Irish Independent and then later KCLR. What initially drew you to, I suppose, this story in particular? Obviously, it's got those flashy elements to it, but to kind of devote so much time to it, obviously, there must be something more to it that really got you into it.
Garamila Magathoran, yeah, there was more to it. I think I was fascinated by the DJ Carey story in particular, because he was there in plain sight for a very long time, and he was a massive hero, just such a fantastic hurler. But there were things that didn't always make sense about DJ. And as a young journalist, I thought maybe there were things that I missed or where he was in my blind spots. And I'll explain that. So he had a business and at the Celtic Tiger. He was kind of at the height of his fame in a relationship with Sarah Newman. And many of us would have felt very sorry for him, because it seemed he got wiped out in the crash. He bought properties at exclusive golf resorts in Mount Juliet and the K Club, and then it turns out they weren't worth a fraction of what the mortgages and the loans he had taken out on them for. So his business as well went into liquidation. There was money missing from his accounts. Revenue and auditors were called in. The narrative around DJ was that this was a nice guy, we thought. He was under pressure in his business, and there was a lot of sympathy for him in the community where I'm from, in the southeast of Ireland. So I'm a Carlow woman, but I worked in Kilkenny for many years. So I thought DJ was a straight up guy, but actually there are so many contradictions there all along when you start to really dig into the story.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, I was listening to a few other interviews you'd done already, and you were mentioning, obviously, as talking about what you just said there, that big respect for DJ back in the 90s before you kind of knew the full story surrounding him. You know, we talk about that. A lot of people even who weren't in Kilkenny would have travelled so far just to go and watch him play and would have been so enthralled by him. But he equally had this sense of like allure outside of just the GAA. It wasn't confined to that niche. Do you think it was difficult to cover a topic like this, especially when he wasn't just confined to something a bit more small, that you couldn't really focus in on just the GAA aspect? You had to cover everything that involved him.
Yeah, it was all encompassing. It was everything. It's the psychology of the story. It's the background of the man. It's a deeply personal story. We're talking about people who know people. DJ is not an ordinary fraudster. That's another reason I was intrigued by this story, because an ordinary scammer just takes the money and moves on to the next victim. DJ spent a lot of time putting in the groundwork, researching his con, figuring out the kind of cancer he claimed to have, looking at literature on hospitals, peddling the story, practicing the story, rehearsing the story, sitting in very well-known coffee shops and business premises in the southeast and pitching that, and not always asking for money. Sometimes he'd ask, sometimes he wouldn't, sometimes he was putting in the legwork. He also targeted people who he was very friendly with, and he seemed to have upped the ante in recent years. From the pandemic on, he seemed to be going at a pace, and really even relations weren't safe. Anybody who came under his gaze, there was a chance that he was going to try and tap them for money. It's important to say not everyone believed his story. Some people knew he wasn't credible. But if you were not in the loop, say, you could have fallen victim, and some people did fall victim to him and were seriously out of pocket. And I know there's this thing, especially around Kilkenny, oh, get over it. You know, what did he do? Sure, he only stole from the banks and a few wealthy people. That is not the case. That is not correct information. Because if you look at this factually, and you look at the pattern of the deception, and you read some of the text messages between DJ Carey and some of his victims, it was very sinister what he did. I would describe some of it, say, with a good friend of his, Thomas Butler from Wexford, who turned out to be one of the people, the star witness for the prosecution, that gave a victim impact statement about how this has affected his life. He did not turn on DJ Carey. The Gardaí came to him. And even at the very last moment, when he was in the Garda station in Waterford, he still didn't believe DJ didn't have cancer. Such was the level of the performance that DJ put in, the acting he did in relation to this fictitious cancer that he had. So it's just, in that case, I felt very sorry for Tommy, because Tommy's a decent man. He's worked all his life. He's a hard worker. He's described in the papers as a financial controller. So that makes him sound like, you know, he has loads and loads of money. But this is a man that got up early, that reared five children, that was about, for the first time in his life, to come into a lump sum, was about to retire. And it's like DJ honed in on that, and he used to invite him to games of golf, and there was lovely exchanges between them, going for a round of golf here and there. But he was reeling him in, and he met him at a hotel on the outskirts of Wexford one day, and Tommy had money in his pocket, because, as I say, he was about to retire. First time in his life he had a small bit of spare cash, but this was to basically so that he could have some kind of comfort as an older man getting on in life with his family. So he had money in his pocket because he had decided that day he was going to buy himself a new set of golf clubs. And what did he do? He took the money out of the pocket and he handed it straight to DJ. And there were lots more asks after that. But he did that because of the gut-wrenching and heartbreaking details that DJ gave him that day in that hotel, when he said that basically Tommy thought he was helping a dying man, and DJ even said he didn't have the money for the fuel to get back to Kilkenny. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he was one of over 100 people you spoke to throughout the process of this book, and I know you noted it a few times before, but there always seems to be a sense of the dramatic when it comes to covering a story about DJ Carey, whether it was something minor, even just back in early days, or coming forward to even now. But when you look at trying to write a book like this, how difficult was it to even just discern what small parts of the story were true as opposed to being dramatised?
Yeah, that's a great question, because like the best lies have some truth mixed in, and I could see that I could substantiate some of the, say, information DJ would give to the media about what you would think would be a straightforward story, say his car was stolen. So you'd think it'd be straightforward. How much money was in the boot? How many mobile phones did you have in your car when it was stolen? How much is the car worth? You'd think these kind of things across media reports would be fairly consistent. But there would be, some of it would be true and some of it would be grossly exaggerated, because I don't think every journalist is getting absolutely, you know, a different account, huge discrepancies in how much money was left in the car, different information given to the court than the media, all this kind of stuff. It only seemed to ever happen to DJ and around DJ. I even remember as a young reporter having a certain amount of stress around covering stories about DJ, because it was never straightforward to substantiate them. So I did a front page story in 2012 on how DJ had fears over blood clots on his brain, how he'd gone to the US for treatment. That is what he was telling people in a public forum in Croke Park one summer. He was talking in a corporate box about that operation and telling every Tom, Dick and Harry there what was happening to him. Yet he never had surgery in the US. So if the horse's mouth is telling you there's something wrong with them, you tend to believe them, because for journalists, you can't go anywhere else to substantiate a health story because doctor-patient confidentiality. So DJ was so brazen that he went to a national audience. He was on The Late Late with Ryan Tuberty. He was on with Ray Darcy on national airwaves. And he talked about his health. He talked about brain aneurysms and procedures and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Who knows how much of it is true, how much of it is false?
Obviously, near the end of the book, you note that you reached out to DJ on many occasions to kind of explain some of his actions, but he remained uncooperative. Is there at least one thing that you would have wanted an answer about, and what would it have been?
Why? Why would you do this to the people who trusted you and loved you?
It's a really sort of strange one, isn't it? Because I know obviously you've spent so much time going through it, and even reading it myself, I felt like I was maybe starting to piece bits of the puzzle together along with you in the book, and then you kind of come to the end of it, and I feel like, you know, the way you mentioned, obviously the guilty pleas at the end of it are kind of the end of the story, but you're still left with so many questions, aren't you?
You are left with questions about what he did with all the money, but there is nothing left. There certainly weren't hallmarks of high life towards the end. When the game was up, there was all along, I suppose, there were signs of high life and then there were signs of low life. And I'll give you an example of that. When DJ Carey was homeless at one stage, he checked into the Lyrath Hotel for 7 weeks. Now, that's not the norm for homeless people. Mm-hmm. That is not something that you would do if you found yourself homeless. You can imagine the cost of that, and he only left a small unpaid bill behind after 7 weeks. He spent most of the time in his room having room service delivered to the room and claiming that because of his cancer he had to isolate.
The Dodger, DJ Carey and the Great Betrayal is out now, and as mentioned, with the audiobook coming on December 4th. Eimear Ní Bhreanán, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, brilliant stuff. And there is so much more to that interview, and you can hear Audrain's full chat with Eimear over on our website. It's beat102103.com/podcast, or if you head over to the Go Loud app and search for Sports Beat Extra.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rappel on Beat 102-103.
It's Beat. You're listening to The Sunday Grill. It's that time of the morning that we call Movie Review with RBG.
Yay.
Who?
Best guy.
Miss me?
Well, see, I was off as well, so I didn't really, because I also wasn't here. So
did you have moments where you'd go?
Yeah, I think last week was probably one of the first weeks where neither of the two of us did it. I'd say about 5 years.
So Audrain filled in for you.
Audrain filled in, Aoife filled in to you.
For me. So well done to both of you, and thank you very much.
Yeah,
we're back. We're back in the fold.
It was great, I heard. So.
Was it?
Yeah, probably.
Was it?
I don't know.
I was in Lisbon.
I was
eating
in bed.
Custard tarts.
I was probably asleep.
Okay. And I had a good bit of winter sun, and then the next day in Lisbon there was just a deluge of raining, so I missed out on that.
I never asked you how your holiday was, because I haven't seen you.
It was only like 3 days in Lisbon with my school friends.
That's nice. Yeah. You had a good time.
We had a brilliant time. Have you been to Lisbon?
Never.
Amazing.
I was supposed to go there on my road trip last year, but then there was like wildfires on the exact road that I was supposed to be driving on.
Now, do you know what I'll tell you about Lisbon?
Well,
and I know I'm a tourist, but full of tourists. So it'll be like going to Temple Bar in Dublin. There's obviously a part of Lisbon that I haven't seen that's for the locals,
yeah,
because I just saw American tourists.
What's a non-tourist part of
Dublin?
The Ballymun of Lisbon.
Yeah, exactly.
Bally Lisbon.
Even the Ranelagh of Lisbon is what I should have been going to see, but no. Anyway, let's talk movies. And this week's movie sounds a little bit like a movie from a few weeks ago. It's called Running Man, and it's actually adapted from a novel of the novelist who adapted the movie a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Stephen King.
He's breaking it in this year.
He really is, but does he not like the same old trope if it's both about walking and death? And
he just like, he goes for a walk and he's like, yeah, imagine if someone shot me now when I did this. Then he's like, do you know what, I'm feeling a fit phrase, going to go for a run. He's like, oh, a lot of people are trying to kill me while I'm going for a run.
What a brain. What yeah. a brain. Anyway, it's directed by Edgar Wright, who you'll know from Shaun of the Dead. And he had did he have a weird magician-y type movie a few years ago as well?
He had, no, it wasn't, Last Night in Soho.
Yeah, yes. You liked that, I seem to
I did, and I saw it at Venice.
Oh, I don't believe
yeah, it's been a while since I've mentioned it. It's been like two or three years since I've been, you know, which is crazy.
Well, it hasn't been two or three years.
Because that's been a running joke for us.
Since you mentioned it last. Did you know that Brian went to the Venice Film Festival?
Yes.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Running Man.
Ben Richards, 35, married, one child, in medical crisis.
We need money for a doctor now.
Ben, watch us up.
Employment status. Blacklisted. But there's still a way out for you. It's the biggest show in the country.
Lust is our birthright! Set it free! Welcome to the Running Man!
People on these games never come back.
I'm not trying to get myself killed, so kiss my ass twice.
Right there is why you can win this game. Rules are simple. Survive 30 days with the entire nation hunting you down. And get your family out of Slumside for good.
There you go, that is Running Man. And what is the running time of Running Man, Brian?
It is 2 hours and 13 minutes. Now, I will be fair, you don't really feel it.
Okay.
Let's be real. We get caught up in the craziest things because you watch a 3-hour movie and it's great. If the 2 hours are full, you don't mind it. Like, I watched a two-hour, there's an Eddie Murphy documentary out at the minute.
I like a reality thing.
And I watched a two-hour, like, that was a two-hour thing, I think, on Netflix,
okay,
and I watched
that
last night. And
Wolf
no
of Wall Street is probably the last time I really appreciated.
It's like a three-hour movie.
That's a
generational movie, though.
That is a generational movie.
Do you know, I was thinking that, like, a lot of great movies, especially comedy movies, because there's a comedy element in this, but a lot of great comedy movies have been made into series now. Because I was thinking about it, if Pirates of the Caribbean was made now, it would be made into a series.
Oh, like a bingeable type thing. Yeah.
Whereas, like, I think when they bust all these things into one movie, there's so much happens in it.
But then it's a number of movies, so maybe it's a number of seasons then as well. Maybe it's our attention span.
Yeah, but I just think that they should, instead of, like, they should map out a season for something and then just put it into a movie.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Anyway, let's talk Running Man.
Yes.
And the movie it reminds us of is
The Long Walk.
The Long Walk, which was also written by Stephen King. And they both have this kind of same premise. The Long Walk, I was so into the idea of this, and then you told me it's just walking.
It is. I thought the same thing. No, it's just like a dystopian future where the government is gone awful and the world is awful, and the only way to win money is like game shows where people die. And you know, like, sometimes you're just like, because Long Walk, it's a case of, well, honestly, for both of them, it's a case of if you want to sign up for these things, you can.
Yeah.
And there's a chance you'll die. There's a good chance you'll die.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like in those scenarios, it's like, if you want to go for it, fair enough, you know? Because I know I would watch a show if it's like, yeah, no, they're hunting down a fella to kill him.
And it is your own right, or not right, but if you want to do it, you do it. Unlike the Jennifer Lawrence stuff that I've forgotten the name of.
Hunger Games.
Hunger Games, which is this horrible element of
yeah,
these people
like
being
picked
out.
Yeah, like, you have to do it, yes.
Yeah, it was horrible. I hated
but
that
But to be fair,
it.
She also signed up herself for that, but she...
Oh, she did, yes, she did.
Sister.
Katniss. Tell me then, we have Running Man,
yes.
And it's also a choice but you're on the run, a yes. fugitive almost for 30 days.
That's it. So,
and anyone in the world can pick you out.
Anyone in the world. So, like, so
we had a beat competition like this a few years ago.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that this this film started production slightly yeah. after that. So,
ooh,
I want to say that we're probably like the inspiration for this entire thing. But if we ignore the fact that there's been a book written and a previous yeah. movie made,
yeah.
we were probably the
more
direct
than 30 years ago.
Yeah. Ah, that's before I was born, doesn't count.
Yes, nothing does.
But no, so this, so it stars Glenn Powell
mm-hmm.
and Josh Brolin. And it's it's basically Glenn Powell living in a place called Slumside, which oh. I feel like they didn't really take much time with the names.
No.
And he basically wants to get his family out of there because his child is sick and he can't afford medicine.
Okay.
And he,
and what's this? Is it a yearly game or a sporadic game?
It's
or?
Just like the newest season of a game. So okay. there's no really like time thing on
it. It's a bit
like
it. Squid Game.
It's essentially, it's very Squid Game-y.
Okay.
The only thing about Squid Game is like Squid Game... like it could happen in the world right now, but like only rich people will watch it and we don't uh-huh. know if it's happening, which okay. I always thought was a really fun element of Squid Game, mm. whereas something like Running Man is like it's dystopian kind of future.
Okay.
And it's always like that kind of like, I feel like dystopian movies made so much more sense in the 80s because I think originally Running Man was set in 2025 and it was like made in the 80s.
Wow, okay.
So like now it is 2025 and it's like, we're not really there, do you
no,
know? So if
no
like it was,
cars.
And then if it's like set in 2050, it's like that's maybe that's not the way the world is going to no. be in 2050.
No.
So I don't know. I think that that whole idea of dystopian futures isn't really a thing anymore because the world itself is actually kind of so depressing.
Yeah, but we seem to be so into it at the moment, like lapping these up in the cinema.
Yeah, well, it's a case of it's set more in a realistic tone because I think in the original Schwarzenegger one, it's like this crazy event that happens, whereas this is more like it's a game show. And it's just on telly.
Okay.
And this is what you watch. And there is, to be fair, at one stage, there's this show that keeps coming up. It's like, it's kind of as if there's nothing to watch. But there's a show called The Americanos, which is clearly a parody of Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
Oh, okay.
Which is actually kind of funny, to be fair. Because it's like,
that.
It's so very clearly the Kardashians.
Oh, I love that. Okay. So a few nods to how we're living today.
Essentially. But okay. yeah, so Glenn Powell signs up for The Running Man. If you can escape for 30 days and not be killed, you can win $1 billion. And I'm not sure the exchange rate between new dollars and euro, but I imagine it's a good bit.
And tell us, does he do it? No, don't tell us.
Yeah, so the exact ending of the movie is...
All right, let's black pudding it.
So yeah, well, I was going to say what I thought of it. Yeah, I thought it was quite good. Or no, so it's a good movie. It's a fun movie. It's Edgar Wright. Like Edgar Wright is one of my favorite directors,
and
always will be up there.
About this, why was
he's a proper cinephile, uh-huh. right? So when I was like getting into movies, especially like Shaun of the Dead. My mom hears Shaun of the Dead, she shrieks because I made her watch it so many times. Shaun of the Dead, At World's End, Hot Fuzz, honestly three
They're
of my favourite movies of
okay.
all time. Scott Pilgrim is great, Baby Driver I loved. Last Night in Soho went down a different route to okay. what I actually liked. And then this is kind of down that more niche, if you grew okay. up in the 80s, loved that kind of cinema, that's what kind of the avenue, whereas I'm kind of more James Gunn type stuff. I love okay. James Gunn now.
Now, I loved Baby Driver, but more for the soundtrack than anything
yes,
else.
Yes, the soundtrack.
The radio.
Okay. There was a bit of good soundtrack. Keep On Running by Tom Jones is in this a bit.
Oh, great.
Which
okay.
is a fun one.
Let's black pudding it.
I will give it like 8 out of 10.
That is 8 out of 10 for Running Man. It is in cinemas as we speak. Thank you very much, Brian.
No problem.
Will you be talking to us from foreign climes next week?
Maybe, maybe not. I might get you before I go.
Lucky me.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rapple on Beat 102-103.